From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. An advisor to Vice President Mike Pence is testifying on Capitol Hill today as part of the impeachment inquiry. Jennifer Williams was on that July 25th phone call during which President Trump asked Ukraine's president to investigate Democrats. Meanwhile, there's yesterday's Washington Post reporting that President Trump asked Attorney General William Barr to hold a news conference to say that he, Trump, hadn't broken the law during that phone call. Barr declined. NPR Washington reporter Tim Mack joins us now. Hi, Tim.
Hey there.
And to Jennifer Williams, testifying after a number of officials declined to do so this week. What do you make of that and what we might learn from her?
So she's a top aide to Vice President Pence, and she's testifying on this in this ongoing House impeachment inquiry. She's a longtime Foreign Service officer. She was assigned to be the vice president's special advisor on issues relating to Europe and Russia. She was given this assignment back in the spring, and she would be the first person from the vice president's office to testify in this probe. Now, she's the third person, however, who was listening in on the July 25th phone call, that now famous phone call between Trump and the president of Ukraine. She'd be the third person to testify. And it's interesting because she gives a different perspective, right? Which is what was the view from the vice president's office? Vice President Pence obviously has in the time over the last few months been involved in this Ukraine issue, has had outreach to the Ukrainian president.
Yeah, well, and of course, we have open hearings with witnesses next week, so we'll be hearing more between now and then about what she might have said. To the Attorney General, General Barr, who many saw as falsely characterizing the Mueller report in his summary before it came out, declining, according to the Washington Post, President Trump's request that he, Barr, announce at a press conference that Trump had done nothing wrong in that Ukraine phone call. Now, this morning, the president tweeted that he never asked William Barr to hold a news conference. And Barr did not hold one. But a DOJ official did say at that time no further action was needed about the phone call. About the whistleblower complaint about the phone call. Others, obviously, including administration officials who've been testifying, saw the call as a problem. So where does this reported request fit into all of this?
You know, it's interesting, right? It fits in with regard to how the president has wanted to shape this inquiry. As questions have been raised about the appropriateness of his actions with regard to the Ukrainian government, this obviously shows that the president wanted to shut down criticism early. So according to these reports, President Trump passed along word through staff that he wanted Barr to go on TV and declare that he had broken no laws in pushing for the Ukrainian president to investigate a political rival. Barr obviously declined to do so. According to the Post and the New York Times, the president has told associates in recent weeks that he wished that Barr did in fact hold that press conference to absolve him of any sort of criminal liability. As you mentioned, Trump has fired back in a tweet at 12:08 a.m. this morning. He wrote that it was a, quote, totally untrue and just another fake news story with anonymous sources that don't exist. But we should also note that the president continues to praise Attorney General Barr both publicly and privately. So this is not some sort of sign of a schism between those two figures.
Yeah. Just briefly, former National Security Advisor John Bolton was scheduled to testify today. That is not happening. Where are we in whether or when we might hear from him?
You know, Bolton has indicated that he would be willing to testify only if a subpoena compelling his testimony is upheld by the courts. He'd obviously be a really important figure to learn more about this informal and formal these informal and formal channels between the United States and the Ukrainian government, which is, of course, the focus of the entire impeachment inquiry. Although Bolton has said that he would only testify if the courts upheld the subpoena, it doesn't look like the House Intelligence Committee is going to be going down this route. A House Intelligence Committee official told NPR just a few minutes ago that they have no interest in getting into this legal process given the timing and the schedule of their impeachment inquiry. They're going to consider his lack of an appearance quote, evidence of the president's obstruction of Congress.
Very briefly, Congressman Jim Jordan, staunch supporter of President Trump, has indicated that Republicans will subpoena the whistleblower to testify. Now, the president today tweeted out that Joe Biden and Hunter Biden should also testify in the inquiry. Democrats have the votes. They can veto Republican witnesses. That's not likely to happen. But what does it tell you about the Republican strategy going into next week?
Well, Republicans have continued to insist that there was no quid pro quo and that the military aid to Ukraine was ultimately released. So there was no wrongdoing of any kind. That they also point to that transcript. The president has, you know, regularly points to the transcript and says, and Republicans agree with him, many Republicans agree with him, saying, look, he didn't directly link a specific ask with a specific deliverable in that transcript of a call with the Ukrainian president. And as such, there was no quid pro quo. Mm-hmm. These have been kind of the leading lines of argument for Republicans in the last few days.
Yeah, well, we will we will hear more as the day goes on. Tim Mak, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
There is other news going on in Washington. You may remember President Trump promised to end the AIDS epidemic by 2030. And yesterday, the Department of Health and Human Services took a step it sees as part of that strategy. The administration sued drug maker Gilead over the patents for HIV prevention drugs Truvada and Descovy. The drugs are used by people who are HIV negative and at high risk of contracting the virus in order to keep them negative. The White House says Gilead is infringing on government patents and earning billions of dollars from taxpayer-funded research. For more, we're joined by Shefali Luthra, correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Shefali, what exactly is the government claiming?
The government is claiming that it has played a critical role in the development, not necessarily of the drugs themselves, but discovering that they could be used to prevent HIV. And we've heard of PrEP, which is, right, you take this daily pill, mm-hmm. and if you stick to this regimen, you're basically not going to get HIV. Gilead has the two drugs that have been indicated to do this, and they argue that the government's research wasn't that meaningful in discovering that it could be used as a preventive pill. The federal government says otherwise and argues that Gilead is now making billions worldwide off of this drug that's gotten very, very expensive, almost $2,000 a month, and taxpayers are seeing nothing in return.
Well, and it's $2,000 a month in the U.S. right now, although
yes.
in other countries it can be as little as $60 a year.
Absolutely, and that's part of this big discussion we've been having around drug pricing, right, where we do pay a lot more for prescription drugs in the United States than other countries do for often the exact same drug.
Well, and we should also point out that many patients who use this drug in the United States don't pay that $2,000. Their insurance company does.
Correct, although there is some interesting nuance around there as well, right? We've seen the shift in how insurance plans are designed, and patients are responsible for a lot more of the out-of-pocket costs themselves, and many more are seeing, if not the full $2,000, a lot more of the price hitting their own pockets.
So could this lawsuit by the government make a significant difference in who gets access to Truvada and to Descovy?
That's a really good question, and it sort of remains to be seen how the White House will bring this lawsuit forward, right? There's definitely an avenue in which you use this lawsuit to negotiate a lower price for the drugs. Right now, the statement from HHS says that they are asking, or asserting at least, their right to both license the drug to other companies for use as PrEP and demanding royalties. That may or may not bring down the price. If it does, that could certainly affect access. If they also get royalties from Gilead, they could use that to purchase more of the drug or to fund other types of HIV mm-hmm. prevention.
What is Gilead saying in its defense?
Gilead argues that the government's patents are invalid and that they... that it was very widely known, they say, that these pills could be used for HIV prevention.
So you think that this is possibly just a negotiating tactic by the White House to force Gilead to lower its prices? It doesn't actually think it's going to move forward with this lawsuit?
I don't know. This is a really big step. We haven't seen a move like this from the administration or from the federal government that I'm aware of. Perhaps we have, but it's a big difference in how they've approached drug makers. It could be a negotiating tactic. It could be a more serious effort to enforce how pharmaceutical companies use government patents. I think we have to see how it plays out.
Well, and it also brings up a question of where it stops, because the government could probably make the case with almost any drug that's out there on the market that its research at the NIH had something to do with the pharmaceutical company figuring out how to make a drug and sell it to patients.
And perhaps not almost any drug, but there has been a shift, experts told me, over the past decade, maybe longer, the NIH used to play much more of a basic research role, and it's shifted to being more involved in the translational research, including the in-human trials. So not all drugs, but many more new drugs than once were, are developed with the government playing a major role. So there could, in theory, be a better fit. That said, there is very distinct political pressure and momentum around HIV prevention, right? The White House has talked about eliminating HIV by 2030, and there's this very vocal advocacy community that's been lobbying quite effectively on this issue. And it's interesting to question or to see whether that sort of perfect storm could coalesce around other drugs, other diseases.
That is Shefali Luthra, who's a correspondent with Kaiser Health News. Shefali, thanks.
Thank you.
We want to spend some time over the next 2 days in Paradise, California, where a year ago that campfire raced through town, burning 95% of it before it was finally put out. Our co-host Tanya Mosley is based in Los Angeles, and she's gone north to Paradise for this painful anniversary. Tanya, just tell us, where are you and how does it feel to you?
Well, Robin, I am at the very busy intersection of Skyway and Clark Road. And as you can hear, people are doing what they do at this time of day, headed to work, headed to school, going grocery shopping, all the things that you do. But I chose this intersection because it's significant. It is only one of a handful of ways to get in and out of Paradise. So when that campfire began to ravage this town around this time last year, this intersection was jam-packed with people at a standstill in their cars, frantically trying to get out of the city. And just to give you context on how fast this fire spread, it was spreading more than a football field a second. Mm. That's really hard to wrap your head around. So it really goes without saying that this place is forever changed. 86 people died as a result of the fire. And as you said, pretty much everything was burned to the ground.
What a grim picture you paint. But we hear the life behind you now. Paradise still stands.
That's right. People are rebuilding in this town, and a lot of folks want to come back. And you spoke to quite a few people during that time last year, and we heard from those folks that they're resilient survivors. We heard that saying, Paradise Strong. It really is the rallying cry that says to the world that we are bent but not broken. So 1 year later, we wanted to come back to really see how people put the pieces of their lives back together. And we're doing that through the journeys of three Paradise survivors who've chosen different paths to rebuild their lives.
Thank you for meeting with
Don't
us,
make
Tina.
Me cry.
Hi.
Don't make me cry already. Get the sympathy look. Don't do it.
No, it's not sympathy.
No,
it is.
Let me tell you really fast, too.
We start with 57-year-old Tina Balasik. You heard her. The moment we got out of our car to meet with her, she wanted to make clear that she wants no sympathy. Paradise is her home, and she wants to tell us about it.
My grandparents lived here, both sets of grandparents, and my parents grew up here, and I married my high school sweetheart, and I can't imagine. I've been to beautiful places, but I can't imagine giving this up.
But Tina was forced to give up the paradise she knew last year when the campfire tore through the town. On the morning of November 8th, while raking leaves in front of her home, she got a call from her daughter 3 hours away in San Francisco, telling her that she needed to evacuate. Still in her pajamas, Tina spent hours in her car frantically trying to get out and watching helplessly as fire tore through her neighbors' homes. Some of those neighbors died. Feeling hopeless and certain that she was going to die, Tina decided to make some calls.
I was able to talk to all three of my kids, and propane tanks were blowing up around me, and I'm saying, I'm sorry, I'm not going to get to watch Jackson grow up. I love you. I'm so, so sorry I didn't spend more time with you guys. And, you know, Mom, don't be silly. You're going to make it out.
So you can imagine what it feels like for Tina to meet us here on this plot of land she recently bought with her FEMA money. On it sits a trailer she bought just a week ago. She's got a word she uses to describe herself.
Brave as hell and scary. And, of course, I'm still not comfortable here. And every time there's wind or, you know, the anxiety just builds in your gut constantly.
Most of the hollow, burned-out structures in Paradise have been torn down, and it's only if you look closely that you can see the tree trunks in this wooded area are actually black and not brown. Then there are the logistical headaches of rebuilding. The town of Paradise has received more than 450 permit applications for building, and so far, only 11 homes have actually been rebuilt. Tina hasn't even applied for a permit yet. She'll be staying in her trailer until she can save up enough money.
You can live somewhere else. Why are you coming back here?
It's in my blood. I raised my babies here and fell in love here. And all the pros of my life, the pluses happened here. And the sadness here. And I grieved it and I grew and I survived here.
Carrie Stratton feels the same way. The 41-year-old mother of two was also born and raised in Paradise. And for the last year, she and her two children and her husband have lived in a trailer next to the plot of land where their old home once stood. She calls where they live now the compound.
The compound is three trailers living pretty much camping. You know, this is my son, Tanner. Tanner, come say hi.
Hey, Tanner.
Hi.
Yeah, how's it been going for you this year?
Not bad. I kind of enjoy, I mean, it's different living in a trailer, but I'm kind of getting used to it.
The trailer is nothing special. It's small, a little cramped. But every morning, the Strattons get to look out of their trailer window and see their new house being built.
It's amazing. Like, I'm looking forward to it a lot. It'll be awesome.
Carrie hopes they can move in by April.
I really feel like we're somewhat of pioneers, you know, of the new Paradise. And, I mean, the people who are coming back have, it gives me goosebumps. Like, we have a, you know, heartfelt want to be here.
The day of the fire, Carrie and her best friend, Christy Voigt, raced to save each other. Christy's two boys, Carrie's two children, and a few belongings. After all was clear, they settled together on this plot of land, three trailers, including Christy's mother, Carol Gilbert, who also lost her home. There's a feeling of jubilation now in the air. Just last week, Christy and her mother, Carol, closed on the property right across the street from Carrie. Carol says the decision to live so close to each other permanently happened one night while sitting in their lawn chairs over a fire.
And suddenly the three of us women were sitting there one night, the old lady and the two young ones, and looked at each other and said, "We can't live without each other." I mean, it was like, we have to make a change. We had lived here together and we're closer than families. And so here we all are with, we're going to be there and they're here. And it makes me cry of happy, happy tears.
There are lessons learned this time around in the rebuilding of Paradise. New building code requirements have been enacted to help lessen the rapid spread of wildfire. The old wooden houses that easily caught fire are now gone, and the town now requires the clearing of wood and debris near homes. Carrie Stratton sees this all as positive change.
As a community, I think that we can really lead the force, though, and make sure that we're prepared and this doesn't happen to us again, or kind of lead the way so it doesn't happen to another town.
There's also the reality that a year later, there are less people who live here now. And in some parts of town, people still can't drink the tap water. So many businesses where people worked are now gone. Just to give you an example, there used to be several dental offices in Paradise, and now there's only one. And some people, they'll never be coming back.
I will never go to Paradise again. I will never drive up there. I've already seen one house burnt down. I don't want to go up and see the whole town burnt down because it's never going to be completely rebuilt like it was before.
We spoke with Christopher Keir by phone from his new home 3 hours away in Russian River. The campfire in Paradise was the second time Christopher lost everything in a wildfire. Yes, you heard that right. The first time was the Tubbs fire in Santa Rosa the year before.
I actually watched the fire march down the ridge above my house. I had probably 15, 20 minutes. And then I decided I would move to somewhere where it was more affordable, as Santa Rosa is not very affordable. So I moved to Paradise.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. Whoops. Christopher's home was destroyed along with his sister and niece's house in Paradise. And just this year, Christopher had to evacuate from his new home because of the Kincade Fire. His house is okay, but if another wildfire forces him to flee again, he plans to move out of California.
I call myself the poster child for climate change. I've lived here in California almost my whole life. I mean, we always deal with forest fires, but not urban forest fires.
These fast-moving wildfires are a horrifying new normal that leaves survivors left to figure out not only where, but how to live. It's a big struggle for Tina Balasik, the survivor we first introduced you to. She doesn't want people to feel sorry for her, but it's tough.
Yeah, I have a lot of determination to go forward. And then days where I'm so tired and I think, why me? Why not me? Why am I here? Why are they not? You know, I want to go home. Every other thought is, I just want to go home. I just want to. It's priceless what we imagine home to be, sitting on our deck at the end of a day on our swing that we splurged on, you know, and have our glass of wine or our morning coffee and know that we've done our day good and we've helped somebody, or, you know, like, that's gone. Now it's all about, this isn't even my property. But I'm going to try.
A year later, life in Paradise. It's far from where or what it was before the fire. But through the determination and grit of the people who still live here, they're trying to turn it into something new.
I am proud of myself. Thank you for reminding me.
For Here and Now, I'm Tanya Mosley in Paradise, California.
Saturday morning. Your week was long. Your time is precious. But why not take 10 minutes to catch up on some of the biggest news stories with Up First, NPR's morning news podcast. I'm Scott Simon.
And I'm Lulu Garcia-Navarro. Up First, here at weekday mornings, and now every Saturday at 8 Eastern, too.
Stocks jumped at the open on Wall Street this morning on hints from China that there could soon be a de-escalation of the trade war. China said today that it has reached an understanding with the U.S. that both sides will roll back the tariffs piece by piece if, and here's the big if, both sides can sign what's being referred to as phase one of a trade deal. For more, let's bring in Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Hi, Ali.
Hey, Jeremy.
And we should keep in mind that so far China and the U.S. have not signed phase one trade deal yet. So how significant is this news today that they're committed to beginning to remove tariffs if they do?
Yeah, that's an interesting way to say it. They're committed to phase one, beginning to remove right. tariffs. I think it's an evolution. I think it shows that there's a softening on both sides. It is a significant sign of progress. You're seeing that reflected in the stock market today. However, there's no actual news. There's no timeline. We don't really know what phase one looks like. We don't know how much of a reduction in tariffs it's going to be. So I think the sign here is that everybody's a little tired of this thing. We're probably going to stop the bleeding.
Meantime, as this is all going on, there seem to be these other moves by both the U.S. and China that may or may not have something to do with the trade war.
No.
And for instance, today, China sent 9 fentanyl traffickers, that's that very deadly opioid,
yep.
to prison in a sentencing that was very unusually publicized. Is that related to the trade war, and what other actions like that are taking place?
Yeah, so there's a few things. President Trump has made fentanyl from China a point of contention in the broader trade talks between Washington and Beijing. So these are the first convictions to arrive from China's joint investigation with America into smuggling of this painkiller that's been blamed for thousands of overdose deaths in the United States. So that's a big deal. Chinese state media late yesterday reported the Chinese customs are considering removing a ban on U.S. poultry that was in place long before the trade war. It was actually a response to bird flu back in 2015. So President Trump has said that China has agreed to buy about $50 billion of American farm goods. We haven't got that confirmed from Beijing, but it does seem like everybody's trying to do things to get back to the table, lower the rhetoric. This is hurting China's economy, this trade war. It is definitely hurting America's economy. And there's some fear that given that some of the world is on the brink of recession,
we don't want this to be the thing that tips the globe into a recession.
Okay, so it's interesting that you said, given that some of the world is on the brink of recession, and as we speak, the stock market is near record highs.
Interesting.
Right now. So is that about China or other things?
The world is slowing a little bit, but in the United States, we have this problem in that interest rates are so low that if you have excess capital, which wealthy people and institutions have, there's nowhere else for it to go but the stock market. So that's not to say that the stock market is artificially propped up, because earnings are strong and most economic indicators in the United States are strong, but the stock market is the place to put your money. So we've got a couple things going on. We probably have a worsening economy, but investors in the stock market have bet that they can take their money out of the market at some later point when it shows that a recession might be coming. But for now, things are good.
You know, there's a word for that. I had never heard it. After years of covering Wall Street, it's called a TINA market. There is no alternative.
That's
what
right.
TINA stands
that's,
for.
And, it's, and that's what a lot of people say. What am I going to do? If I'm not in the stock market, I'm going to put my money in a bank where I get 2%. Right. They're not interested in that.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent. Thank you.
Thanks, Jeremy.
A group of former students from five of Detroit's worst-performing public schools is suing the Michigan Department of Education and Governor Gretchen Whitmer for a lack of textbooks, classrooms without teachers, overall horrendous conditions. We reached out to the department and the governor for comment. They declined. But the governor has said that the state addressed Detroit public schools when it returned the main school district to a locally elected school board in 2017. And Governor Whitmer also points out that Michigan spent millions in 2016 to create a new school district called the Detroit Public Schools Community District, which is free from debt. A similar class action lawsuit was filed in Rhode Island in 2018 after students there accused that state of failing to equip them with the skills to function productively as civic participants. And in other states, after court rulings, state legislatures have been forced to find more equitable ways to distribute education dollars. But the Detroit case was already thrown out by a district court judge who said, while alarming, education isn't in the Constitution. The case is now on appeal in a circuit court. Jamaria Hall is one of the plaintiffs. Now, he graduated in 2017 from Osborne High School. Now 20, he's trying to get through community college in Tallahassee, Florida. We'll hear about that. Jamaria, welcome, and make your case.
Yes, and thank you so much, Mr. Young. Thank you so much for hearing out, for having me. But it's just, like, education is the basics to life. Like, how can you be a productive citizen to society without literacy or without being proficient in math or reading above a third grade level?
Well, and you talk about your schooling in Detroit's Osborne High School being a big waste of time. How bad was it? What were some of the things you're pointing out?
I mean, it was really almost like a prison. It was like going to jail every day or going to daycare. Like, we're sitting in classrooms for hours upon hours watching movies, going from different class to different class, or maybe going to school and not knowing if you're going to have a teacher, going to school knowing that you might have to wear your coat in the classroom because it's below zero outside and there's no heat in the building, or knowing that it might be 90 degrees outside, so it might be 110 inside the building, so you might be sweating bricks, and then not having efficient water to drink, or not having an efficient bathroom to use, or not even a shower or a locker room.
So the conditions are one thing, but you also mentioned watching movies. Do I understand that there are long-term substitutes, you know, almost permanent substitutes who just showed films? And in other classes, you had materials for upper classes, but they were labeled for third graders.
Yes, ma'am. Like, Detroit is the only city in Michigan where a teacher can teach a class without having a degree in teaching or having a degree in that subject. And it's kind of sad because the teacher is teaching a class that they know nothing about or that they are not mastered in. A lot of times I might help a teacher, or like we said, there might not be a teacher at all. And we might be sitting in a class watching Frozen or something like that.
The movie.
Yes. Like, I was born in 1999 and the books in the classrooms were from 1998. Like, the books are older than me. The last president in the books are Clinton.
I mean, but, you know, you mentioned teachers who are teaching without having the background. Some of these teachers are as angry as you are. There's one quoted Renee Shankman, who is at Experiencia Preparatory Academy, which has closed, but she said she didn't even have a curriculum. She had to use Google to learn how to teach some of the topics that she was assigned. I mean, some of these teachers are as angry as you. Here's another point that's made in this Detroit case, filed in 2016, by the way, on behalf of you and other students, that there were such appalling conditions that there was an eighth grader who taught math to his classmates for a month after his teacher quit.
Yes, ma'am.
How do you see that impacting you?
It impacts everyone. You can see it on the incarceration rate. You can see it on the death rate. You can see it on the dropouts rate. You can see it on the gross income of the city. You can see it. It impacts everyone, not just the students, because these students grow up to be adults. These students grow up to have children. And it's a cycle that's been long gone. And my father is also a teacher. He also taught at Osborne. So I really understand how it is both sides. And that's why it was not towards Detroit or Detroit. The lawsuit was not really towards them because they don't have the resources to teach us. A lot of times teachers come to school 2 to 3 hours early to make 500 copies for all the students in the classroom out of the one textbook they might have. And then this is paper that they have to buy out of their own money. And it's like, I know the teachers care. I know the students want to learn. The people in the community want better.
Well, so you've really outlined terrible conditions. And as you say, it's not the city as much as the state and the attitude towards the schools. But how do you go about making a legal case? Because as you know, other school systems have tried and other judges have said, you know, nowhere in the Constitution does it say you have a right to an education. So how are you making the legal case?
I mean, nowhere in the Constitution it doesn't say that it's not or that it can be deprived. So it's a gap in the room. And it's 2019 and we're sitting here talking about education.
Yeah.
Like, how can we live in America or live the American dream or want to be a owner or something or want to have a career when I'm not proficient past a third and fourth grade level and it's putting me or making me a statistic and just saying that I'm not going to be anything or that I won't achieve anything. Basically putting us in a category, putting us in a box. So many people should at least pay attention to it because it's not only affecting Detroit, it's affecting everyone. I'm not saying that all schools need to be perfect, but I'm saying that everyone at least needs to have a chance. I'm at least saying, can I, my textbooks be from 2019 if it's 2019?
Yeah.
Can I not have leftovers? Can I not have word downs? Like if we're at the bottom, we want to try to get out. Education is the way out. We shouldn't have to want to be basketball players or artists or things of that nature to be the only way to get out the city. And it's in the Constitution that everyone should have a right to the American dream. And if you don't have education, how can we get that?
Well, that's the point that some people are making, that it doesn't necessarily say in the Constitution you have a right to an education, but you do have a right to, as you say, the American dream, the right to vote, participate mm-hmm. in a democracy. And, you know, there is an argument there that you can't do that if you're not literate.
If you're not proficient.
Yeah.
Like, how can you do it if you can't read this poll, if you don't know where the voting polls are, or if you don't even really, you haven't got past third or fourth grade knowledge to really even know what's going on.
Well, and Jamaria, I mean, what was that like when you went from this high school where you had a great, you know, what, B plus or something, and you got to community college?
It was really a slap in the face, kind of like a reality check, because I graduated second in my class and I had the highest SAT score, and I had aspirations of going off to a university and things of that nature, and to go off to community college and to be struggling with my classes or to not feel confident enough to take even the proficient or the regular freshman classes I wanted to take, really remedial or classes that would help me build up to at least get to a level, just knowing how much I missed out during my 4 years at Osborne. So I knew I had a lot of catching up to do, but it was still really a reality check when it was way much more than I thought.
Yeah. Others make the point that education is compulsory. And how can you compel someone to do something when it's not good for them, you know? And that the Supreme Court has ruled that you can't compel someone to do something and then not deliver on it. And for kids, that means sitting in school and not deliver an education. You can't, you know, as others have pointed out, you can't put someone in a mental institution and not provide treatment. Well, you know, that might be an argument that can be used. It's something you're also forced to do. Well, what are you doing now? I mean, struggling in community college because of realizing the education you didn't get. So what are you doing?
I'm still trying to catch up. It's 3 years later. I've graduated 3 years ago. I still have freshman credits. I'm still catching up every day. I still have a private tutor that I work with. I still stay in the library because I know I have a lot of catching up to do. And I've failed classes. I've had to retake classes. And I'm just like every other student, every other college student, just trying to aspire, trying to move on. But I know I have so much more work to do than everyone else. So I'm just trying to really work hard.
So, Jamaria Hall, we wish you all of the best.
Thank you. Thank you so much. Thank you all for even having me. Thank you so much for even having the chance to listen.
When public hearings start in the impeachment inquiry next week, the media will play a more central role as Democrats in Congress try to take their case, which has so far unfolded mostly behind closed doors, directly to the American people. But already, media outlets have had to decide how far to go in trying to figure out and report about the identity of the original whistleblower who kicked off the impeachment inquiry. Some have claimed to know who it is. Others, like NPR, have avoided reporting the person's identity. And the president continues to call for the name's release. Here he is speaking on Sunday.
But the whistleblower should be revealed. Because the whistleblower gave false stories. Some people would call it a fraud. I won't go that far, but when I read it closely, I probably would. But the whistleblower should be revealed.
NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik joins us now. Hi, David.
Hey, Jeremy.
So the New York Times first reported details about the whistleblower last month, and now several media outlets claim to have revealed this person's identity. Which outlets have done that and why?
Right. So the Times, you know, did it up to a point. Editor Dean Bakke said, look, the White House already knew that the source worked for the CIA. They revealed at the paper that he had been assigned to the White House and worked on Ukraine issues. But you've seen much more explicit, you know, claims made about who the identity is. And we don't necessarily know that it is for sure. But you saw from Breitbart, a strongly conservative outfit that has been deeply pro-Trump. You've seen real clear investigations, real clear politics, and that family of sites, I think, by and large, is fairly down the middle. Real clear investigations takes more of a conservative bent in what it chooses to investigate. In this case, they ported that out. And you saw conservative media figures like Mark Levine of Fox News, that has his own show on The Blaze, and Jack
Mark Levin.
Mark Levin, excuse me. And Jack Posobiec, he's a conspiracy theorist who ostensibly is kind of a correspondent for OANN, the One America News Network, also a deeply pro-Trump site. He circulated that on Twitter, as did the president's son, Donald Jr. So there have been conservative figures taking the lead from conservative sites that have essentially heeded the president's call and put out the identity of whom they claim the whistleblower is.
Well, what's the ethical calculation for the media organizations that have decided not to try to identify the whistleblower?
And as you mentioned, includes ourselves, includes The Washington Post, includes The Times so far, and includes, among others, Fox News, where according to CNN, Fox didn't respond to my request, but according to CNN, there's been an edict put out saying we have not confirmed or corroborated the identity of the whistleblower, and we don't feel comfortable reporting it so far. The ethical concerns is what the idea of what a whistleblower is. It's somebody who can come forward but have his or her identity protected to make claims about his or her employer, in this case, about the federal government, in this case, about the White House and possibly the president himself, the most serious and influential figures in the country, without harm to his or her career. And if you identify the person publicly, it's much easier for there to be pressure built up, reprisals inside government, or you know, certain kinds of attacks, or rhetorical or actual, outside of it.
Now, the president's son, Donald Trump Jr., did tweet out the unconfirmed name of the whistleblower, linking to an article from Breitbart. But the president has not so far done that. Why has he stopped short of mentioning the name? Could he know who the whistleblower is but have his hands tied?
You know, certainly the president knows who his son has tweeted, who a lot of these figures on media that he follows have written or tweeted about. The president appears to be keeping his powder ostensibly dry, happier for other people to carry the water for him on this. And, you know, I think he – if there is to be a backlash against the president's allies for outing the apparent identity of the whistleblower, whether or not accurately, it would certainly be much more fiercely done against the president, who, of course, is subject to the impeachment process that was sparked by the whistleblower's complaint. So I think the president is seems to be following the edicts of his lawyers to try to keep his nose dry in this particular very narrowly defined way.
David, there are parallels between this whistleblower and Deep Throat, the anonymous source behind Watergate reporting. FBI officer Mark Felt did not come out as Deep Throat until three decades after the scandal broke. What do you think about the contrast between the two?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I mean, Backe at the time said, look, we think it's fair to give people a sense of what the motivations or at least positioning is of a person in a nonpartisan agency with some expertise to make this. In terms of Mark Felt, let's remember, Deep Throat never appeared even as an unnamed source in any of Woodward and Bernstein's original reports for The Washington Post. He emerged as a character in their best-selling book, All the President's Men, in the movie of the same name, and became a folk hero. It turned out he may have been, as they said, a patriot deeply concerned about what the president and his men were doing. And at the same time, he turned out to be a kind of a vicious, brutal infighter in the FBI who had hoped to ascend to the top ranks of that agency, which is another prism through which to look at what he had to say. In terms of the whistleblower and in terms of Mark Felt as well, the real question is, do the claims hold up? And in claim after claim, ensuing transcripts of depositions of witnesses seem to strongly support what the whistleblower has said, making his identity, to many media executives' minds, a lot less relevant for readers to have to worry about.
And yet Republicans say now that they want to call the whistleblower to testify publicly next week. So we'll see what happens with that. NPR media correspondent David Folkenflik, thank you.
You bet.
And Here Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here Now.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. 30 years ago, the world watched in amazement as Germany celebrated the fall of the Berlin Wall. The symbol of Cold War division still resonates with Berliners today.
The freedom is very expensive. Everybody is responsible to keep it and to struggle to keep it.
That's next time on Here and Now.